This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to Fanny Merkin's 50 Shames of Earl Grey and help keep this wonderful show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook. A 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes, you need more in life than a banana peel and a well-timed shove to say no to a mime artist.
All I had was 50 cents, so you know how bad I feel.
One more time.
All I had was 50 cents, 50 cents, 50 cents. All I had was 50 cents, so you know how bad I feel.
Okay, so I'm here with Andrew Schaefer, or at least Andrew Schaefer insists that it's Schaefer. It could be Schaffer, it could be Schaefer, but I'm going to refer to you as Schaefer. Andrew, how are you doing? You are most recently the author of 50 Shames of Earl Grey.
I am. I'm doing well, thank you.
You're doing well. And you are the author. Or is Fanny Merkin the author?
It's up in the air right now.
Oh? Yes. You could go back to Andrew Schaefer?
Schaefer or Schaffer.
Maybe Schaefer is the pen name and Schaefer is the real man.
Well, you know, I've been toying with doing a romance novel for a couple of years, and I always was wondering, am I going to do this under my own name, or am I going to do this under a pen name? And it just turned out that it was like, you know, it's not going to, under my own name, it just kind of felt I was just a guy sort of mocking this thing, you know?
Well, you're a man of many identities on Twitter as well.
Yes, yes. So it really felt natural to sort of write under a different voice and just assume a different role. So it came pretty naturally.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you require multiple identities to go about your life? Do you require self-deception and various disorders in order to function as a creative artist, an emerging voice of our times?
You know, it's interesting. I never had before I got online.
Oh.
I never experimented with pen names or alternative identities or anything. I was pretty sure I knew exactly who I was.
And then the internet came along and had you constantly questioning yourself.
The internet came along and I became sort of one person online on Twitter, and then I became another person, you know, for my friends, and another person at work, and another person for my family.
Yeah.
And
you turned into Lon Chaney.
Yes, yes. I just sort of portrayed this different face to everybody. Yeah. And
except so it was through words.
Yes.
And text.
Yes.
I mean, there were avatars involved.
Yes, and sometimes dressing up, but not too much.
You dress up sometimes when you tweet or when you write? You pull like one of those Tom Wolfe things where, well, I wear the white suits in public, but when I sit down for the typewriter, it's all jeans all the way.
Well, you know, I do wear kilts a lot when I write, but not to assume a different identity, just because they let my balls hang out.
Oh, I see, so. I see. Well, we were talking before we were rolling, or before I insisted that we roll, because I want to get this very important info on tape, that there actually is an index. It's not in the galley that I have, but there is an index TK. So I'm wondering, why did you feel that this hefty narrative required subjects and topics to guide the reader through the life of Anna Steele here?
Well,
what is this index? What are some of the samplings?
Oh my gosh! So it's not common for a work of fiction to have, you know, an index. But that was actually something that my editor at DiCapo suggested.
Yes.
Was, they have that form where they fill it for every book, you know, are we going to have an index? Are we going to have a table of contents? She's like, you know what? What if we did have an index? And, you know, it's lists on there, you know, where particular sex scenes are at in the book.
Oh, I see.
It lists.
That would have helped me, because it does take quite a while for the first sex scene to happen.
Yes, yes. The first sex scene.
Well, I had patience for you.
It's delayed.
I was willing to wait for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, but it was just really, you know, in the original book there was sort of this. People would say, "Oh my gosh!" They would go through and count up how many "Oh my gods" there were or whatever.
There are websites for this?
Yeah, people have counted up. Like, I came across like 97 "Oh my's." You know, it's just one sentence. "Oh my, oh my." And so people have actually counted up how many, because it's repetitive. And I think if there had been a traditional editor on the original books, they would have cut that out. But so people have gone through this. I said, you know what? I'm going to have that in my book. So when
you did
I
that
overuse
with
Guidettes something,
and you did that with bees.
Yeah,
all that?
Yeah. So wow. Well, so some of the stuff. So at the end of the book, the index actually says like, oh my, and then in parentheses, overuse of. And then I list like every time I've overused that phrase in the book.
And it's a great way of expanding a page count so you do less work. Or do you? Do you have some sort of sub-editor go ahead and deal with the index? You assign someone else to do it, and meanwhile you sit back and collect your hefty advance?
Well, you know, the
living like the Lord of the Manor?
The funny thing about that is that every time they compile an... They ask you if you want an index compiled, and who does that is the copy editor usually, or your editor or something. And so they ask for what are some things you would like to have in your index. And so I gave them a couple of ideas, but then the copy editor just sort of fell in love with the book and just created this whole list. She's like, I hope it's okay that I inserted my own stuff in here. And so she kind of put her own different things in there.
The copy editor fell in love with your book.
The copy editor
didn't
just
like go ahead and get out the ruler and wrap you across the wrist like they usually do.
No, I had an instance with I was just talking to one of my other editors at Harper Perennial today. I had an editor on my first book, a copy editor that didn't seem to get all of my references, and so it was very awkward when I got back this copy edited manuscript, and I think I had a chapter titled something like it was a book on philosophy, but I had a chapter titled like it ain't nothing but a G thing, baby, or something.
Yeah.
Something along those lines. And I got this back from the copy editor, and it had been like crossed out. It said like, it is not anything except for a G thing.
They're a little stingy there at Harper.
I just think that it was clear that she didn't get the reference.
Yeah. Have to forward YouTube links to copy editors in order for them to actually understand what you're talking about.
I think it's coming from a good place, and I'm glad it makes my book look a lot better, when it's copy edited and edited and everything. Sometimes I had to, set stuff with that book. And for this one, I'm like, there was one joke in 50 Shames where Earl Grey says, I'm part of the 0.00001%. He says, I have certain perks for being part of that. And so it's written out 0.001%. And in the copy editing, that got changed to actually written out. I'm part of the 1 millionth percentile. And I'm like, it just kills the joke, you know? So
is there like an Andrew Schaeffer style guide that you have for Harper and for DiCapo?
For DiCapo, they created a style guide, actually, that had everything listed out, all of the different stuff. It was just the most bizarre list of stuff, and it's actually mostly what appears in the index, but it was just like different. There were dinosaur names, Cosmoceratops, which is a dinosaur, and I actually got into a great back and forth with my copy editor on the correct ways to capitalize and italicize dinosaur names and stuff. And so I think the copy editor was great on this book. She just she totally got it. But I think we learned stuff from each other. I think it was a good working relationship.
Were there any sort of shall we say belligerent conference calls at all, or any sort of David Foster Wallace style long ask emails about if you cut this particular phrase, and there's like a 6-page explanation, anything along those lines?
Oh my gosh. I really rely on the editors, like I said, to sort of make me look good. I think that a good editor is just invaluable, at least for for me. I think maybe there are other writers that can turn out a great first draft, but I'm not one of them. So I'm thankful for all the help I get, and so therefore when I usually get stuff back from them. I usually go with everything. I really set very few things out of manuscripts because I think that, I'm like, okay, this, they've really got us a great idea of where this should go, probably better than I do sometimes. But, I was a little concerned when I sold this book. I did not know the editor who bought the book. And when I looked her up on Publishers Marketplace, everything else that she had done was for the most part like vegetarian or vegan cookbooks.
I see.
And I was like, did you think that Earl Grey was some sort of food book or something? Is it, I'm like, oh no, this is not a book about tea.
You could have made Anna Steele a vegan.
Oh, I could have.
I'm sorry to have only proposed that idea.
Hold on, we've never.
I would have known if I would have been there during the creative process.
But no, it was, and I'm actually a vegetarian. I was like, did you sign this book because I'm a vegetarian? Is there some kind of club I belong to now
really?
Or something?
They can smell it on you.
I know. I didn't know.
I didn't know you were vegetarian.
It's probably
is this
about
a fairly
six
recent.
Months. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you had any like dark meat cravings, like, climbing up the walls at night, screaming like the Lost Weekend or something?
No, because I'm actually a pescatarian.
Oh, you're one of those. So I can eat fish.
Yes. But I don't. I always explain it as vegetarian because I have a very hard time. Like if I explain pescatarian, it will lead to other questions like my mother's like pork.
Yeah.
Can you eat pork? I'm like, okay, let's just go with vegetarian and just assume I can't eat mini meat.
Well, we're in New York here. We have plenty of pescatarians. In fact, everybody I know is a pescatarian. I'm one of the last guys who eats red meat around here. I had a burger for lunch though. You know. Yeah. So I did, without guilt, although I did dine with a pescatarian. So.
Well, I ate meat for many years, and it was for cholesterol reasons actually
that I
switched over. So, but the editing of the book. So, one of the interesting things was so I sent the draft in to the editor, and she sent it back to me after a couple of days, and I think the first note that she sent back, because I was a little worried. I was like, oh my God, is this going to totally change? You know, I hope she has a sense of humor.
Yes.
And the first thing she sent back was, well, in 50 Shades of Grey, there's a scene where Christian Grey says, I want to fuck your face, Anna. And she's like, how about if we have her say to him, I want to fuck your eyeballs? Or something, you know, and I was like, okay, this is good. This is not going to be, you know, toned down at all, you know, from what my vision was. But after we worked on it for the past 2 months, so I wrote it in about 10 days, but then we worked on editing for 2 months on it, and it really evolved into, we were having a lot of fun using the more euphemisms that we could. For instance, I don't really use any of the standard slang you would find in an erotic novel. There's no pussy or cock or dick or anything. She calls her vagina a Katy Perry.
Yes.
And calls his dick a James Franco.
Yes.
So it was definitely something that that the editing process changed things quite a bit. But I think I was really pleased with the direction it went.
Sure. Well, this also leads me to wonder, I mean, first of all, how many times did you and your editor have to comb through the original 50 Shades? I mean, you know, this came about really quite quickly.
Yes.
And, I'm wondering, you know, when you're fashioning a parody along these lines, especially since there's a financial motivation to get it out there earlier, to ride that 10 million wave that 50 Shades laid down. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, how much prep time does a parody generally require to get it right? How many times did you read Miss James's work?
I know exactly how many times I read it, which was twice. I read the three books twice. Well, except for the third one. I skimmed the third one a couple times. You kind of get the idea after the first two, but what I really wanted to do with this was, what I sort of saw as a theme emerging from 50 Shades of Grey was that, you know, BDSM is this scary thing, and Christian Grey's into it because it's really dark, and it sort of made him more mysterious and alluring, but also scary, you know, to Anastasia, and so. You know, I really wanted to sort of turn that around, and in 50 Shames have it be something sort of different, which was turn it into, you don't have to be ashamed of the stuff that you're into. You know, your kink is your kink, or whatever you like. You know, whether it's live action role playing, or you're a Trekkie, or whatever it is, what you like is should not be something you're embarrassed about or think is something that, you know, makes you dark and scary.
A confessional then here from you, Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
This idea, because there's a lot of role-playing, a lot of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I mean, I almost said to myself, you know, he only named this Earl Grey so he can get that Earl Grey tea hot gag. Which is a reference to Star Trek.
Yes, it was.
Yes,
it was,
yes,
definitely.
Yeah.
That was not why I named it that, but after I figured out I could work that gag in, it just sort of worked some other sort of different sort of geek culture sort of stuff, you know, stuff that I was really into, that I was able to sort of work in there. I was like, and a lot of that came after the book was sold. I was like, hey, I've already sold this book. You know what? Now I'm going to revise it. I'm going to just put in stuff I like. You know,
yes.
I'm just going to go all in and just kind of do whatever I wanted. So I think, you know, by the time the first draft that I had really was just sort of the first book of 50 Shades of Grey. It kind of touches on the second two books a little bit. And then it also touches on the four Twilight books. So this is I kind of cover seven books in one book. I mean,
yeah.
what a deal.
Did you find more inspiration in Twilight than 50 Shades? After all, 50 Shades did start off from Twilight.
Yeah, so 50 Shades started off as Twilight fanfic, and I really, I drew a lot from the sort of fan communities that built up around, Twilight or 50 Shades or any of these other sort of fan properties.
I don't think any of the fan communities clamored for a 69-sided die, though.
No. So some of that stuff I sort of threw in there started off as sort of maybe like a visual reference. Like the 69-sided die, for instance, started off as
Which doesn't even exist. I actually Googled this because I was damn curious if there actually was a 69-sided die. You would think in our age of,
Right?
Yeah.
Right. It just, something like that just came about. I actually designed a t-shirt with a 69-sided die, and then I worked backwards from the t-shirt.
You need to have physical manifestation of that die, not as a die, but as a t-shirt.
As a t-shirt, and then it worked backwards.
Pastiches from pastiches, going back to the original pastiche.
Yeah. So some of it was just sort of like, I'm going to try to work in this stuff, and, you know, from sort of a different angle, I guess, than normally you would probably think, hey, I'm going to create swag, you know, from my book. You know, that's based on the book. I went to the swag first. I was like, what would be a cool t-shirt?
So you did the whole Corman thing of creating merchandise and then trying to implement that merchandise in this.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. It was
getting the hefty advance wasn't enough for you, sir.
No.
Mr. 10 Days pounded out.
No, I needed more. I just felt like I needed more.
You have like a nice little sort of like, you know, I'm going to the dark side look with your hands right now. Just to clarify.
Yes.
Yeah. We could be plotting world domination. We may very well be.
We could.
You are, certainly.
I am.
Your palms are so close together. I mean, I admire your world domination gesture, your posture.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Some of the first stuff that I sort of hit off creatively on was I had greeting cards.
Yeah.
Greeting card company where I
can't imagine why.
Well, it was where you could do something funny, just really short, funny, sweet. A lot of that stuff then I had turned into like t-shirts and stuff and sold some t-shirts and that was just always a way, that was always some of the most fun I had. I kind of spent my 20s trying to be like a Philip Roth, Raymond Carver, serious novelist.
Yeah.
And I pounded out really terrible novels.
How many truck novels are we talking here?
Oh, we're probably three at the most.
Okay.
But terrible, you know, I was like, I mean, stuff that I had no idea, I was in my 20s, I had no idea what I was even talking about, you know?
Neurosis, doubts.
Yeah,
you know,
I had my own neurosis, doubts, and angst, but I was actually trying to channel them through a 60-year-old voice of Philip Roth or something, and that came from sort of being in proximity to the Writer's Workshop at Iowa for so long, and it wasn't until I sort of gave that up and said, you know what, that's not for me, I started doing these shorter things like greeting cards and t-shirts and stuff, and I said, you know, I like this kind of humor, and then, got the genius idea to actually say, what if I wrote a book using some of that humor, you know, and sort of buried the neuroses and the angst, you know, but I think the neuroses and angst is still there. I mean, the first book I did was Great Philosophers Who Failed at Love,
yes.
and which is a very depressing book.
Yeah.
It's you're not gonna walk away from it happy, but
I did.
Well,
but then, you know, I knew going in to it what I was getting into.
Yeah, yeah. I just advise people, you know, keep it in your bathroom. Read a chapter or two at a time. Don't.
I read it. In fact, I read some of it while walking.
There
you go.
There you go.
I didn't read any of it in the bathroom. So did I read it the wrong way?
Should
people read all of your collected works in the bathroom? Should people read this book in the bathroom, or should they proudly flaunt it on the F train and say, you know what, damn it, I am reading a parody of 50 Shades of Grey?
Yeah, I would say reading a parody in the bathroom, I don't want to, well, if you say, I mean, I did have someone say, they said, you know, I laughed so hard I pissed my pants, and I was like, that's going to be a great blurb. I was like, did that really happen? And they're like, well, no, and I'm like, well, I don't know. What if that did happen, you know? What if that started to be a thing? That would be great marketing.
I laughed so hard I lost my pants.
Wow.
There you go. How's that for a blurb?
That would work.
Well, I have to also ask you, because the sense I get from you, because you're on Twitter almost all the time, or seemingly all the time, although I do notice that on the weekends you do depart, and I'm glad for that, because I know you're living a life. I have to ask, Did this book sort of spring out of sitting around the house or being bored or something? Because it seems like a lot of your ideas tend to spring from just like, oh, I'm online and I'm creating another self. And, well, here's something I can do. I could do a 50 Shades of Grey parody, or I can be Emperor Franzen, or I can do something else. I mean, you know.
Some of those are side effects of working from home.
Oh, I see. I see.
And not having much discipline, or it's taken me a long time to have discipline.
You leave the house, right?
I go to coffee shops sometimes. I like working from coffee shops. But I think what happened with this one actually was it came out of Twitter.
Yes.
I started live tweeting my review of 50 Shades of Grey, and based on the response I got on there and on a subsequent blog post that I did on it, a lot of people really responded. At the same time, I felt that 50 Shades of Grey was kind of an easy target, and I said, you know, I kind of feel like I'm, you know, I don't think E.L. James expected it to blow up like it did.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that she deserved to take a lot of the shots that it did, you know, for it being porn or whatever. But yet I found a lot of funny things in it. And I was like, you know, what if I sort of channeled my live tweeting, sort of, people liked the humor in that, but I was like, what if I channeled it in a more positive direction, you know? And so that's kind of how 50 Shades of Earl Grey came about. And then I started writing it, and as soon as I started writing it, over the weekend, the first couple of excerpts I did of it got like 2,000 hits, which for my small blog was quite a bit. And so I sent that off to my agent, and she's like, well, maybe we have something here. I don't know. She's like, can you get to me by next Monday? And I was like, the whole thing? She's like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, sure. Because I had done the typical author thing that I do with books in progress, which is lie to my agent, or sort of fib and say, she said, how much of this have done? And I'm like, yeah, it's in 20,000 words or so, you know. And I had
this two, is why it was knocked out in 10 days.
Yeah, and I had 2,000 words.
Yeah.
She's like, can you get me 40,000 words by next Monday? Because that's only, you know, it's only 20,000 words to go. And I'm thinking, oh, no, that's only 38,000. But yeah, sure, I can do it. Yeah, I can totally do that. Yeah. Yeah, so, but I mean, at that point, 50 Shades of Grey wasn't, it had just sold to Random House that weekend.
Yeah.
And so, and it had only sold in ebook, like 100,000 copies at that point.
Yeah.
And so nobody knew it was going to blow up to 10 million, of course. So, I mean, that was quite surprising that over the next week as I worked on it, it kept climbing and climbing, and then when they announced like their first printing of a million copies or whatever, you know, that was the point that my agent was like, we have some actual interest in people putting this out, because I was just like, I'll just put this on my blog, I'll just, you know, sort of self-publish this, if you will. It worked out differently. So,
well, it's interesting because something that you started doing just for fun ended up turning almost instantly into this very high pressure financial commercial decision. And I'm wondering how you dealt with that writing. Were you sort of groping at any kind of straw to get that 40,000 word manuscript. Does this explain, for example, like halfway through the book, we get this note like, and we have half of the book to go. I'm reading this going, you know, Schaffer's like really looking for anything here. Schaffer, rather. You know.
That was actually something that was added in at towards the end of the book.
I see.
I went back and found the halfway point and added that. So, I was kind of stretching at first. I was like, the first three chapters pretty much follow scene by scene what happens in 50 Shades of Grey. And then from that point, you know, I started to sort of go off the rails, if you will.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you don't have a plot or anything, you know, I was just kind of like just writing. I was like, I had no idea where this was going to end up. And then I was like, well, I wanted to sort of have, I guess, more of sort of a Twilight feel the deeper you get into it. And so you have an intense birthing scene, which also happened in 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
There was stuff in 50 Shades of Grey, actually. At that point, I had only read the first book, though.
Yeah.
There was stuff I parodied in there that... I started reading 50 Shades of Grey later, and I realized that she had also done some of this stuff that I had actually pulled from Twilight. Because at that point I was like, so it wasn't until I finished the book that I actually had read all the 50 Shades of Grey books, and I was like, oh my god, we were pulling from the same material.
So you had that sort of Meyer emulative voice down, just as she did, and thus you were able to hit the same sweet spots.
It was really kind of strange how that happened. There was stuff I come and be like, and then I'd be like, shoot, I gotta take that out. James already did that, already did that. And I was like, and so it was really interesting, but
you were competing against James herself.
I know.
Which one was more outlandish? I mean, that was probably the question you might have been asking yourself as you were writing some of this. Like, wow, she actually did something more ridiculous than I did. Was there anything like that? Or?
Oh my gosh!
Explain, like, for example, the wonderful string of handkerchiefs that are pulled from a rather intriguing spot?
Yes. Some of the stuff, like in James' book, there's a scene where Christian Grey pulls a tampon out of Anastasia, and people were like, wait till you get to that scene, and I was like, oh my god, you know. And it ended up not being that bad of a scene in James' book, but I'm like,
why stop there?
Yeah. What else can you know? Just started thinking about what a magician would do.
Yeah,
you know, I stopped short of the rabbit. Although there is an animal though, but I think, you know, I think some of that stuff, I was like, I thought that James took some stuff pretty far, like the flying the helicopter around and, you know, and having a helicopter pad on top of his building and all this kind of crazy stuff. But at the same time, I'm like, you know what? This guy is like the super richest guy in the world. I mean, wouldn't he have... You know, he's buying her like a Saab or something, a car. I'm like, shouldn't he go a little further? You know, what could he do? And so, you know, I have him doing stuff like flying fighter jets, you know, off of rooftops.
Yes.
You know, I'm like, what's the most ridiculous thing you could do? Because a lot of the stuff that he does is, I'm like, it's ridiculous, but it seems like something Kanye West would do, you know?
Yeah. And that's where Tom Cruise came from.
Yes.
Because you were rather fixated on Tom Cruise. I thought perhaps a little too much. I mean, you know, I'm not sure how many people are going to really care all that much about, say, Cocktail in 2012. I mean, unless you know people who are like heart Cocktail diehards or something. You long for that moment of adolescent theater when Tom Cruise walks away with Elizabeth Shue defiantly. Of the parents' wishes and so forth.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing was for this book I had to do, I did research. I just went out and bought every Tom Cruise movie and watched
them. You did?
Yeah, I was actually like watching them out of the corner of my eye while I was typing.
This might explain why the 12,000 page quiz is in there. Sounds like Scientology.
Yes. Well, I just thought, I did love, you know, Tom Cruise movies as a kid. It was just something I was like,
you want to be Tom Cruise?
Oh no! But
did you ever? At what point did you think that Tom Cruise wasn't so cool?
Oh my gosh! Oh boy! What point did I think? I think the couch jumping on Oprah was pretty much when he sort of jumped the shark, I think. But
he jumped on the couch.
Yeah.
Unless there was a shark on the couch. No.
Well,
are you referring to an idiom or are you being literal?
The idiom.
Okay,
the idiom.
I see.
I really loved... he sort of got on my mind during this book, though, because one of my favorite films is Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, I see.
And I really love how that, and that sort of goes back to sort of the BDSM sort of orgy thing. I mean, when I watched that movie ruined me for orgies for life,
Did it?
And, well, here's the thing. It was kind of...
You always get back on the wagon.
Well, it was kind of like... And it was kind of like in 50 Shades of Grey, where you're like, this sex thing they're into is dark and mysterious, yet... I think the first and only orgy that I was ever invited to, I was maybe like 20 something, and I went to it and I was like, this is gonna be awesome.
Yeah.
And instead it was like people just like sitting around drinking like Bud Light. I mean, they were dressed sort of provocatively, but the orgy never actually even happened. Nobody took their clothes off or anything. It was just kind of like everybody was too timid to do this. And I was expecting like Eyes Wide Shut, we'd all go, it would just be crazy. It would just be this, it's just Roman Caligula, and that wasn't the case. And
even when people do take their clothes off, it's not necessarily a Roman Caligula.
Oh,
it's a lot. It's a lot of like, it's basically like going to a literary cocktail party where people are a little introverted and they're a little shy about talking to each other.
Yeah.
Except instead of drinking, they're also having sex with each other.
Exactly. Yeah. There's the choice of drink, Bud Light, was just like, I was like, it was comical. Everybody was, it was sort of gothic themed, and there were every room in this person's house was turned into a dungeon type room. There were like handcuffs and
nobody used them.
And nobody used any of this stuff. They just got wasted.
This person ever organized orgies before?
This may have been the first one. It may have been the problem, but that's kind of why that was kind of my. I always had sort of this, you contrast real world sex and stuff with what happens in Eyes Wide Shut or 50 Shades of Grey or any romance novel, and I mean, there's a reason you turn the lights off usually, when you're having it. So
yeah.
But I wanted to sort of bring that sort of how ridiculous this is in the real world into this book, because I don't think you don't really see enough of that.
Do you think though that writing a pastiche of a best-selling erotic trilogy gets away from this, I think, very interesting problem about how narrative depictions of sex often ruin sex for people, often create needless anticipations that can't possibly be satisfied. We haven't even brought up porn, which is even worse, but even narrative itself, books, films, they are problematic because they're never realistic and they're very reticent about showing like the female orgasm.
Oh gosh.
I mean, in any sort of realistic way, or even the disappointed female orgasm.
Yeah, that's one thing you'll never see in a romance novel is the woman not having an orgasm or the guy having any sort of problem or anything, between those two people that resembles what occasionally goes on in the bedroom. So it does create a pretty high bar for you to sort of that your own life, you can never live up to that. But I mean, as far as addressing it in the pastiche, I had actually tried to write a romance novel before this. I've tried for a couple of years and a couple of attempts, and they've never gotten off the ground because I just can't get past in my mind, that I can't pull sort of the shades over my own eyes and sort of not see, sex for what it really is, realistically, and not sort of in that idealist sort of way. So I do have sort of this. I review romance novels.
Yes, you do.
For a magazine, but I have sort of, I guess, a love-hate relationship with the requirements of the genre sometimes, as far as what can happen. And there are many romance novels out there that buck that trend. There are erotica novels that are very different, and so it's not all that, but that was something I wanted to address with this, and it's something I might address in like a future nonfiction book.
Yeah.
Because I've I still consider myself primarily a nonfiction author. While I was working on this for the past year and a half, I've also been working on my next book for Harper Perennial, which is called Literary Rogues, about writers who drink, do drugs, self-destruct, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and stuff. And so, you know, and so that's something that is very close to my heart, but it's, you know, I've been working on that for a year and a half.
Yeah.
So this was sort of a distraction from that, but it was a good distraction, I think.
Going to philosophers and rogues, it's interesting that you wish to look at these figures from a purely biographical manner rather than looking at their work, or that's what it seems, even though I did see quite a number of texts cited at the end of Great Philosophers. You failed.
I didn't read any of those.
You didn't read any of those.
Their own texts.
Yeah.
I read the philosophy texts that they had that dealt with Love or Romance, which was very minuscule. It's just not something covered in that. But
what is getting to the naughty bits of a person's life? What does it say about them? How does it supersede their own achievements? What's the purpose of that?
Oh my gosh. You know, it's a good question. In the first book, I had Great Philosophers. I had actually, it was going to be a compendium of, you know, sort of all of their thoughts on love and romance. And then it sort of, as we sort of got the query together and put things together, it ended up being just their sort of sarcastic or negative views of love and romance. And then I had planned to do a second book that was all positive stories. And that book didn't happen because if you look at anybody's life, whether it's philosophers or plumbers, you know,
the funny stuff is the tragic stuff.
Right. You look at anything and close it up. There's not a lot that's, you know, funny about someone who, or I would say, you know, I guess, interesting from that type of biographical standpoint. That's going to really stand out. You can say, oh, they were happily married and they had a couple of kids and they wrote a lot and they were really quiet and they didn't leave the house. And, you know, I'm like, wait a minute, did they have an affair? Something to kind of, you know, make that story some conflict, you know? And so in Lives Without Conflict, you don't really have much of a story. But to your question in terms of, you know, why look at that stuff in the first place, I guess you know, I was just very interested in people's lives, like philosophers. I didn't really get sort of their sort of more vague concepts or any of this kind of stuff, you know, until I sort of saw them as, you know, human beings.
Yeah.
And to bring someone down to the level of human being, you often dig up the dirt on their life and say they're just like you and me. You know, they're no different than. You know, we all have faults, and I mean, and you know, and I don't, you know, and I include myself in there too. I mean, you know, after I wrote the first book, Great Philosophers Who Failed at Love, a year later I got divorced.
Yes, I know.
So you brought
this up, not me.
Yeah, yeah. So I definitely, you know, those type of things, you know, weigh on my mind. But I, you know, it's not that I don't. You know, and I do. I definitely include myself, you know, in that. But I include all of humanity in that. So I think there's something, you know, that's intriguing about people's faults.
But you're writing yourself into an inevitable real life fate.
Yes.
will I see you in a helicopter moving from Walmart to Walmart, or trying magic tricks on the hoochie?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, no. I want to keep my fiction separate from that.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, you know, and also. With some of the sex in this, you know, I can go ahead and trot out the usual highbrow example of E.M. Forster at Aspects of the Novel, saying, write what you know. Well, you clearly knew James's work by reading it twice, but, you know, what of keeping up a wide variety of what Delaney calls pornotopic possibilities? I mean, you know, how did you ensure that the sex in this would, number one, not be so monotonous, and number two, be rather outlandish and funny, and, you know, interestingly enough, in this comic mode, which, you know, if you read Delaney's latest 800-page opus, it's ridiculous. It's, you know, shit eating, snot eating, and this kind of stuff. It's
no, like, I've not read that.
Yeah, no, it's quite an endeavor. But I mean, but he's playing it just as in purely fantastical terms, and you're playing it in purely comic terms. And so the question is, you know, what do you do to keep it interesting?
Well, you know, for I guess I would say that, you know, I don't want to say it's drawn from my own life, but I'll give the one example is, you know, I think, you know, being funny in the bedroom or something is, you know, kind of underrated. And I think, you know, one of the sexiest and sort of funniest things I've done is go to an S&M dungeon with my girlfriend, Tiffany Rice, who is a BDSM erotica writer.
Yes.
And, you know, prior to that, I was like, this stuff seems goofy to me. It doesn't seem sexy. And you find out that the goofiness is sort of the sexiness. Like, so those people, the dominatrix don't take themselves seriously, and
they're playing a role.
They're playing a role, exactly.
And this is something that a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah, and so once you can get into that role, you know, and you realize it's not some kind of deep psychological need for something, you know, but you're playing a role and you're working some stuff out, I'm sure, you know. But it's
either that or therapy.
Exactly.
Or sometimes both.
And it's actually more expensive than therapy,
yeah,
though, by the way. So I've read a lot of BDSM erotica, and I've read my girlfriend's books, and so I know, you know, a lot of that stuff. But at the same time, I've always thought, though, that, you know, stuff in the bedroom, I guess I would say the worst thing I ever did, and this kind of, you know, it's kind of the sense of humor about sex that's in my book, which is, I think I was in college. You can do anything in college, and then you get a blank slate later on that says that's okay to do, because you were in college. I told a girl that I had a really weird fetish in bed, which was that I made race car noises. And that
did she take you up on this offer?
Well, we dated for a while, and
you were forced to go ahead and do the NASCAR sounds.
I was forced to then go through with the NASCAR sounds. I was like, you know, and I was like, it's the only way I can orgasm. And she totally bought into it, and I felt like a jerk. But that, by that point, I couldn't go back on it because it started as a joke. But then I was like, I don't know. Now I seem like a liar, and I seem like
you did break it to her that you had actually lied about this.
Oh, hell no, I couldn't. I couldn't. I was embarrassed.
Why not?
I was embarrassed. I would seem like a liar. I was really just making a joke.
Is this your experience with women keeping a lot of things? Once things are established, even if they're not true, you have to go ahead and carry through with it?
There's probably some truth to that. But yeah, sometimes you kind of back yourself into a corner, and I guess I was just too embarrassed. And there's actually...
And you were in college.
I was in college, so it was okay. But about a couple of years later, there's actually a short story of David Foster Wallace's where he actually writes something very similar to that. And I was like, you know what? It's, you know, that sort of humor, you know, I'm a big David Foster Wallace fan, so I was like, that sort of humor is definitely something that I wanted to sort of work into my work, you know, rather than into, you know, maybe an embarrassing sexual situation I was in, so.
You had some pretty thoughtful things to say earlier about how narrative sex screws up real sex. Mm-hmm. You have, as we have established, reviewed for the Romantic Times.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you have always, or you've been given a good chunk of your life to thinking about how issues of love and sex are portrayed in fiction, portrayed in narrative, and how you can understand them. And you know, do you think you're moving towards some real deep examination of these issues that, you know, a la the Roth-like novels that you wrote before, that you would, you're probably going to go ahead and say, all right, I've been doing the pastiches, I've been doing the books about, you know, rogue writers and philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's time to go ahead and man up and really sort of, you know, deal with these things I've been thinking about for many years. Is this something that has been on your mind? Is there a trajectory here?
Oh, definitely. No, definitely. I think for the past, a couple of years, I've sort of been moving in that direction to where I want to do some sort of, you know, a book that weaves in more maybe sort of memoir, you know, like experiences.
Or fiction,
then,
even.
Yeah, fiction.
You mean to tell me that you can't grapple with the problems of narrative sex versus real sex through fiction?
It has to be memoir for you? It has to be truth-telling for you?
You know, I think, you know, so it's, I kind of fall into sort of the, I guess sort of the David Foster Wallace sort of conundrum where I love his
Don't
nonfiction.
Hang yourself, please.
Yeah, no. I would do something much less, you know, messy. But no, you know, his nonfiction is fantastic, you know. And then it seemed that his fiction, not quite up my alley, but it seemed that his fiction, with his nonfiction, he was sort of reined in and kind of, you know, was able to do the humorous stuff. But then with the fiction, he went all over the place. It sort of went all over the, you know, and there was no sort of through line. And it's a fun journey to take, but it just sort of didn't resonate with me as much as his nonfiction did. And I think,
even The Depressed Person, which to my mind is one of the best depictions of what it is like to have absolutely nobody, no support system, no anything. It's one of the best. I think it's one of the best short stories ever that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess I should make a distinction. His short stories are another
thing. Okay.
I'm talking about,
like, is it a jest you have problems with?
Well, I just have a problem and then I've never finished it.
Oh, okay. It's one of those. When you finish it, we'll have this conversation again, sir.
You know, I didn't feel like I was in such a bad company. I was talking to Elizabeth Wurtzel a while ago, and she said that she's like, don't worry, I'm the only one of my friends that I know that has actually finished it too.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. So I didn't feel too bad.
Interesting in light of, you know, what he and Elizabeth Wurtzel.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She actually showed me a book that he autographed for.
Oh, yeah,
It was fantastic. It's sort of, I guess what I see is if I dove into a novel, and I think that's what I've done in the past, is sort of, you just kind of dive in and you just can kind of go anywhere, and then I can't resist the easy joke. That's, again, probably why I need a really great editor to sort of pull that book out of me. If I have something that's serious and longer, but also with humor, I have to be able to resist that joke, you know. And I think sometimes, you know, you could kind of tell with David Foster Wallace's, you know, in some of his longer work where his editor kind of just said, hey, go with it, you know, go as far as you can. And then I think, I mean, that was even his own analysis of his work. He was like, he just said he you know, runs with it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know. So for me, that's just kind of where I'm at right now. But I'm 33, so I don't think I'm mature enough to tackle it.
I'm not trying to put any expectations. I'm just trying to understand what you think of your voice. I mean, you're in other words, right now, you feel more comfortable going for the comic mode, going for the joke, going for the punchline. Why do you think that seriousness scares the shit out of you?
A joke you can get immediate feedback on, and you know, a joke either works or it doesn't work. You don't know if you know how deeply you touch someone with a serious book. You know, you're not going to get that. I guess you're not going to get an immediate reaction from them. It's going to be a deep seated. It's going to be, how long does that book stay with them? What do they, you know? I think any writer, I don't write for myself to sit there and reread it myself, because after I write it and I'm done with it, you know, I'm not going to crack the book again, you know, unless I have to do a reading or something, right? So I'm not writing to amuse myself. I'm writing, I guess, right now primarily, you know, it's sort of to amuse other people.
Okay.
I guess.
But how do you amuse yourself? Are you amusing yourself as you're amusing other people? Or, I'm curious.
Yeah. You know, I think with 50 Shames, that is probably the first book that I've had where I've really seriously amused myself while writing it. I had a lot more fun writing it, you know. And I think part of that was trying to sort of say, hey, E.L. James wrote hers as fanfic. She had fun. She just did whatever she wanted to, and it came out kind of ridiculous. And I was like, you know what? I want to have fun. And I did. And so...
What happens if you can't amuse yourself?
If I can't?
If you can't. If it's just not working out. Every writer has that just dead spot where it's like, ah, shit, I'm writing nothing but shit. I'm only producing X number of words today, that kind of thing. What do you do on a day like that? Or do you have a day like that? Or do you have enough, do you get enough of a reaction through your various activities as a greeting card magnet, as a Twitter man, or as a guy writing these books for you to ensure that there's this constant feedback? And is there a certain danger to some of that feedback? I mean, you can't please everybody. And
oh, God, no. No, yeah, you can't please everybody, and I would say that, you know, I think some of that, I guess, you know, part of that is just sort of exhibitionism, obviously, and I think through something like Twitter, you know, and assuming various guises on there, I can get some of that out of my system, to where my writing. Isn't just constantly trying to sort of show off or crack jokes. So I think I get some of that out of my system there, but I don't know. But overall, I definitely, you know, have bad days and good days. It's a constant struggle though.
Yeah.
I'm thankful that I have different projects that I work on that can sort of feed different parts of my personality, though, you know. This Literary Rogues project involved, you know, reading well over 100 books. Well, that definitely more than that, actually, over the course of a year and a half of different people's lives and stuff, and, you know, people that I had really looked up to, you know, when I was a kid and stuff. And sort of saying, you know, look at these badass writers, you know, and my sort of view of them has sort of changed, you know. So some of that is sort of, it's sort of like going to school, you know. I really loved going to college, and after, you know, I went to undergrad, I went to grad school, it was for business, but I just liked that sort of lifelong sort of learning thing. And so some of the nonfiction work sort of just feeds that. I'm like, cool, this is cool. I'm getting paid to just research stuff I like. So.
Personal foibles, though, why are they more alluring to you in this manner than the very literature itself? I mean, you know, Dostoevsky, Roald Dahl, total bastards. But I can still appreciate their work, and I would rather go to their work, quite frankly.
I guess it was actually sort of a very personal journey the Literary Rogues has been, which is, I'm looking at these guys that I sort of looked up to when I was a teenager. When I was a teenager, you know, I was like, you know, I wanted to, you know, read the most contrarian work, the Rebels, you know.
Yeah.
I think when I was 12, I read Less Than Zero. I had a paperback of that when I was 12, and I was it was way over my head, but I was like, I was very much into, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are cool, and these guys and some women seemed to sort of represent that sort of rock and roll sort of attitude, and you could kind of tell, like Jay McInerney and Bret Easton Ellis kind of seemed like they lived their lives like their characters.
Yeah.
You know,
seemed like,
yeah, well, you know, at the time I had, you know, no idea, and, you know, they've since distanced themselves from that and said a lot of that was just the press and fiction and whatnot, and people, you know, and there's a huge danger with, you know, conflating your characters with yourself as a writer, but you know, when I was a teenager, I just very much,
sure.
I was like, that's really, these guys are really cool, you know, and I was like, I want to be a badass like this when I grow up. I want to be a badass writer. And so what happened was, you know, I kind of got out of reading books for several years until I went to college. I think in high school it was just music, you know. I'm gonna listen to, you know, Nirvana, and, you know, this guy shoots heroin, he's awesome, you know. And then once you grow up and you start doing, you know, different drugs yourself, you know, and I kind of went through, you know, a long, long phase of time where I didn't write, I didn't do anything. It was just lost time, you know, in college and afterwards. I was like, you know what? And so now I'm relatively sobered up, but, you know, I mean, thank God I didn't have to go through, you know, 12-step programs or anything or any rehab, you know, but I look back on that and say, you know, were those guys as cool as I thought?
And I would argue, though, too, in researching these authors now from Literary Rogues and in reading their biographies, well, how is that, you know, terribly different from reading Less Than Zero at 12 or idolizing these guys back then? You're still looking for qualities in a literary person of iconoclastic qualities or drug-taking qualities or bad behavior,
you know, self-destruction.
Why the hell does this still matter to you?
Badassery.
Even this late in life. Yeah.
Well, what you've touched on there is the central question of my book. the question that I posed at the beginning was there any validity to that? You know, and I think it's you cannot answer the question. If Hemingway had not drank so much, or if so-and-so had not done so many drugs, would they have produced better writing? It's just impossible to know. I mean, you can try to say, oh, well, Cheever and Carver were much better sober, which I think they were, but you don't. It's very qualitative. It's not quantitative. So I asked the question, is there validity to them even being any, you know, cooler? Did, you know, and say it's not something that's, you know, so awesome, but I think, you know, and why aren't there writers like that today? I think that was the real problem I had, was coming to terms with my own, like I said, relative sobriety. You know, I'll drink once in a while, but I don't do drugs anymore.
But the issue is not your history. The issue is why you were drawn to this.
Oh, well.
In terms of your reading and the biographies and all that.
Oh, yeah.
No. I mean, I'm really kind of curious about this, because it's very clear to me that you're both actively thinking about these issues and how narrative destroys or influences behavior, but at the same time, instead of, you know, really pinpointing how narrative can actually tell the truth about behavior, you're instead focusing on the behavior of the people who create the narrative. That's why I'm asking this question.
Yeah. I think that just comes back to, I was really just, so last year, you know, I had my first book out, and I was like, you know, would I be sort of, you know, disappointed in myself as a writer? Am I not living up to what I thought was the dream of being a writer when I was young? You know, am I not as cool as I thought I would be? You know, and so it's as much nostalgia as it is anything else. And trying to sort of dispel, it's sort of a letter to myself as a kid saying, hey, you know, you're not going to be that badass when you grow up, but it's going to be okay. It's sort of part celebrating that behavior, but it's also saying that there are consequences to that behavior. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the conclusion that I reach at the end, you know, it's not giving anything away to say that, no, that stuff doesn't affect, you know, the work as much as or as much as I thought it did.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect the enjoyment of the work. I think that, some of the most subversive works have been, some of the satires have, you know, whether it's George Orwell or Kurt Vonnegut or Chuck Palahniuk, have been written by guys that seemed to have their shit together.
I guess what I'm saying is, why settle for a parody when you actually, I think, can express the real?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah. I'll talk to my therapist about it.
Okay. On that note, I'm running out of tape. But Andrew, it was a pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah.
And let's do this again.
Yeah, certainly.
Thanks. Okay. Cool. Great Dad, beat me. Jimmy's begging. Beat, 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 beat.